Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. I am your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of Pitchlink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Our guest today is Mark Shenkias, and we speak with him about his contrarian book, The Other Side of Sales, An Insider Reveals the Secrets to Dealing with Professional Buyers.
Personally, I've never gone into a meeting with a prepared presentation. Never. Because the first thing I want to do is ask questions like, hey, what's happening? What's going on? What are your struggles? What are you dealing with? What's happening? How can I help you? You know, because if I can't help, there's no point in me trying to sell something. And there needs to be an opportunity to help people. And I rarely found salespeople doing that, coming in with their own story, with their own perspectives, rather than thinking about, you know, what does the other party want? What do they need? And how can I help them achieve that?
Mark Shenkias is founder of ROI10, a globally operating training and consultancy firm focused on making you successful in negotiations, procurement, and sales. He has worked for Mars Inc. for 17 years in a variety of procurement functions and has extensive experience providing training to both sales and procurement professionals. He's also a lecturer of business economics at Fontis University of Applied Science. His book, The Other Side of Sales, gives sales professionals unique insights into the mysterious world of buying. Now, onto this truly behind-the-scenes session with Mark Shenkias. Mark, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm happy to have you on the show and talk about your book, The Other Side of Sales. If you remember our chat early January, what you are doing and the philosophy with which we work and the tools that we are building are extremely aligned. I think there is a gross misunderstanding of what we call the buyer's journey and what it is really like. I mean, a lot of people have called it out. Gartner called it out. We all know about it, but we don't pay attention. But that's later. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start with your background. I mean, tell us about what you have been doing and what prompted you to write this book.
Oh, well, that's a long story, but I'll try to shorten it for people. So I used to work, so after my studies, I started working at Mars Chocolate. So that's a chocolate company, I think also known, very much known in India, brands like Snickers and Mars. And I spent about 15 years in procurement. So 17 years at Mars and 15 years in procurement. And I've seen all sides of procurement, so from operational to strategic, from local to global, what we call directs and indirects. So directs is raw materials and packaging, and indirects are, the categories indirectly related to goods, like logistics. And then about 7 years ago, I decided to leave Mars and pursue my own career, right? So to create my own job and set up my own company. I called it ROI10. ROI is a financial term known as return on investment. So I guarantee a tenfold return on your investment in me. So if you invest money into me, I guarantee a tenfold return just by helping you negotiate better deals. I help both buyers and sellers. And actually, what I realized after 15 years in procurement is that a lot of sellers are focused on themselves and very little on actually the buyers. And I realized, you know what, I could teach them a thing or two about, you know, how to deal with buyers, what's going on inside buyers' minds. And that triggered actually the thought of, you know, why not put it into writing and write my own book about it. So that's why I wrote The Other Side of Sales, which is very much focused around giving insights to sellers, how to deal with buyers, how buyers think and what they can do about it.
Fantastic. We'll deep dive a bit on this, but first let's qualify. When you are saying buyers, you are essentially talking about procurement professionals.
Correct. Yeah, it's B2B, so it's business to business. So it's people who are dealing with professional buyers, buyers in organizations that are trained to negotiate, that are trained to leverage the market, as they would probably say. Professional buyers for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So let's sort of pedal back a bit. When was this? So you left Mars 7 years back. When did you think that I should write a book?
Well, actually, it's always been in my mind, but reality is that if you're in a busy job, it's hard to find time to actually write it. So when I left Mars, I had more free time to think about, you know, things. I came up with all kinds of models and, you know, put together a lot of ideas. Like, hold on, this is something valuable that I've got here. I should put it into writing. But then, you know, no experience in writing whatsoever. So, you know, that's when the whole journey started. But it started with, you know, like an inspiration. I should put it into writing just to make sure that, you know, it's written down somewhere. And, you know, whenever I'm gone, at least my legacy can live on. That was the idea initially. So, yeah.
And which year was this?
That was about 4 years ago. Yeah, so 4 years ago when I started writing the book.
Okay. Yeah. And what was your process? I mean, did you sort of think of, how do I buy? And what are the challenges that I deliberately put in front of the sales guy so that I know that I'm getting that best deal or I'm buying the right thing and so on and so forth. So how did you sort of think of structuring the book? What was going through your mind?
Yeah, well, actually, there were two things that were triggering it. One of them is actually my customers. So my customers came to me with all kinds of issues they had with buyers, and it was clear to me they don't understand how a buyer thinks. You know, they get frustrated because they want to negotiate prices. Although, you know, that's the purpose of buying. You want to get better deals. You know, so, you know, that's their nature. So that was the one thing. On the other hand, I had my own frustrations from real life experience. You know, a seller coming into my office trying to sell me something, and I'm thinking, oh boy, what is your preparation? What is your preparation be? You don't know anything about me. You're just talking about you. You know, what's the point of working with you? So there's a combination of two things that actually triggered this. Thinking, you know, there's a lot of information that's unknown to the outside world. I should bring that on the table. So those were the two trigger points actually that got me into writing it.
So I have a question on this. Whatever you just told, it is no secret. Everybody says that salespeople don't know how buyers buy.
Yeah.
As I said, I referred to Gartner. That's the most referred thing, I guess. There's a spaghetti bowl process and so on. My question is, why is it salespeople who are career salespeople? It's not that they're in sales accidentally and they will get out of sales. They are career salespeople and they still behave like this. What do you think is the reason?
So I think if I think about 20, 25 years ago, procurement was not a profession at all. So buyers were typically, you know, operational people who were also buying next to their job. So, you know, for example, if you were in logistics, you were buying, you were organizing logistics, and in the background, you were also buying the transportation or the warehousing services. So it wasn't a profession. I think about 25 years ago, it became an official profession because people started to realize, you know, there's value in procurement. And what happened next is that procurement evolved rapidly. Mm. So buyers became more professional. They did trainings. They learned how to negotiate. They think about, you know, how to approve suppliers, how to create, you know, a bigger supply base so it can leverage the market. So they started thinking about all these kind of things. But sellers didn't evolve at the same speed. So they were still thinking, you know what? 25 years ago, we'd have a drink with somebody in a bar, you know, we would talk and we would do business. That was the old way of doing business, and it worked. Nowadays, it has changed because buyers have become more professional, and sellers have not adjusted to that level of development that buyers have. So, and that's why they're struggling these days, because they still think, you know, on the back of a beer coaster, let's put the prices down and we get it sorted, versus no, there's a whole tender process and an RFP process in the background, and it's become more professional, and sellers struggle with that. Yeah? So they still want to go back to the old days, but times have changed. They can't anymore. That's what's hard about it.
So basically what I hear you say is that the older way was easier and simpler, so to say, because the world was simpler.
Yeah.
World is much more complex with globalization, with huge cross-continent businesses happening today, cross-continent procurement happening today for raw material. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you were manufacturing chocolates, and where all it was getting manufactured, where all the raw materials were coming from and where all what's getting delivered. It's a very complex thing. It's not simple by any means, right?
No, correct. Yeah.
And you had to sort of manage a lot of, like you said, logistics. I think that's the right point, because that's where I would imagine it would have started that how do you manage the logistics better, etc.
Yeah.
So my question is that, is it simply the yearning for simplicity, or is it some kind of obtuseness or belief that, oh, we still understand it better, we still can get a job done across a drink or a bar?
Yeah, well, that was the old way of thinking, and they still hope that's coming back, but it's not, you know. In the old days, it was very much relationship based. So buyers and sellers had a relationship. They played golf together, or they had a drink together, a meal together, and that's how business was done. Nowadays, that's not happening anymore. Actually, I would say it's the opposite. Buyers are not particularly interested in building a relationship anymore. And I'm not saying all of them, but some are, a lot of them aren't, especially some professional buyers. They want to, you know, they want to leverage the market. They want to play suppliers against each other just to get the best deal. So the relationship part is almost dissolved. So, but it frustrates sellers. And I understand why, because obviously you want to build a partnership. You want to build a relationship. And for buyers, they just want to, you know, typically, buyers' targets are very much driven by how much savings did you achieve.
Yeah.
And when it's about saving, when it's about money, relationship has really no place typically in this kind of negotiation, because you're just focusing on the numbers and less on the people you're negotiating. I'm not saying it's right, but that's what's happening in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and if you think about it, and we'll come back to that when we discuss the book. Let's go back to the writing, because I think I'm jumping ahead a bit. So now that you have decided that you'll write the book, what did you do first? I mean, did you have all the chapters in your mind, or did you jot down something? Were you writing a blog where some of the material was already there? Tell us a bit about that.
Right. So that's a good one. So first, I just started writing stuff down and thinking what should be in, you know. And then the way I wrote the book is a bit like, you know, rafting. You know, when you're on a river, let's see where the river takes me. You know, and then sometimes you push to the side or you avoid the rocks. That's a bit how I started.
Okay.
I'm currently writing my second book. I'm doing it completely differently. Mm. I first start with the structure, and then I'm going through all the steps. In the first book, I just started just to write things down, thoughts in my head, because what I realized is that. The hard part about writing a book is to structure all your thoughts. You have so many ideas, so many thoughts, so many things going through your head. And I just started writing them down, all of them, because I wanted to get them out of my head onto a piece of paper. Later on, I started structuring things like, okay, what is logical first, second, third, you know, just starting structuring the content of the book. But initially, it was just a dump of data from my head into a book. And at the time, there was no ChatGPT, so no ChatGPT that could help me, you know, structure things or rewrite things. I had to do it all by myself, which is different. Yeah.
So after that process, what did you do? Did you sort of share it with somebody, or on your own you kept on sort of, now that you've got the entire data out, now you will sort of, you think, okay, let this goes first, this goes second. What was that process like?
Yeah, actually, so you know, I think the first book, you always think about, oh, I should have done things differently than writing a second book. In the second book, that's exactly what I did. So I had sections pre-read by, it's currently being pre-read by 6 people. My first book, I didn't pre-read, I had it pre-read by anyone. I think one, just one person. And I hired somebody to help me with the editing and the processing, etc. So I hired somebody to do that. But the second book, I decided I'm going to do it myself, and I'm going to get people to pre-read, because I realized, you know, there's so much value in getting a second perspective, because it was just my perspective. And in the first book, I had my editor, you know, provide a perspective. But with hindsight, I would have changed that. I would have done, you know, more pre-reading by people. And right now, I have it pre-read by buyers, by native English speakers, by people who are not involved in sales or in procurement at all, right? So just to get different perspectives on the book. And that's what I would definitely advise for people wanting to write a book. Get different perspectives, because if you're the one writing it, it's just one perspective that you have. And I think it pays off really to see multiple perspectives to the book. Yeah? I would have done that differently.
So I'm tempted to ask, what's the next book about, and where are you in that journey?
Okay, so the next book actually is about creating a category strategy for procurement. So when you're buying something, how to create a proper strategy, a three-year strategy. A lot of people say they do strategy, but none really do. They're very operational or tactical, you know, negotiating, etc., but not thinking, what is my category going to look like in the next 3 years? So first book was for sales. My second book is actually for procurement, to make them better at their jobs, basically. Yeah, that's the plan.
Makes sense. Going back to the book, this is my final question on the writing. Did you actually leave out some of the material that you had when you finally structured? And it's a very quick read from what I see. They're very succinct, very tight chapters and yep. tight subsegments and so on. What was your process there? What did you do?
Yeah, so one of the things I hate when reading books is actually people taking 20 pages to make one point. So I see a lot of books with a lot of content, but they're just going around in circles. And inside, that's not going to happen. My book is going to be really to the point. So it's very short and sweet. Yeah? So it's practical. Every sentence makes sense. If it wouldn't make sense, I would have left it out. So I try to get to the point rather quickly. And as well, what I like about the book, even in hindsight, is that I added a list of questions to ask yourself, you know, in terms of, you think about, you know, one of your buyers that you're dealing with. I ask about 47, I think it's a list of 47 questions where I go through and ask, what did your buyer do? How can you tell they're actually interested in you, yes or no? Are they operational, strategic? Or, you know, what kind of buyer are you dealing with? So it's 47 questions that will help you to really analyze the buyer rather than just, you know, thinking, I read the book, I'm done. No, this book will actually help you going through 47 questions. What is the buyer doing actually, and how are they behaving, and how should I deal with that eventually? You know, so I'm taking you by the hand, short and sweet. You know, no blah blah around it, just to the point. 47 questions, go through them all, and you will have analyzed your buyer, and you're able to deal with them in a better way. And I think that's the real benefit of the book that I created.
Absolutely. Let's get to the book. I mean, you start with why do you need a plan? I think you touched upon that earlier when we were talking, that people walk into a buyer's chamber without really having a plan.
And, yeah, definitely.
And a lot of people will ask, what do you mean by a plan? I mean, I'm going to sell something, so what's the plan? So tell us about it.
So just one simple perspective, you know, just one simple, so there's 47 questions, but just one perspective. If your buyer has five other options to buy from, you know, so if there's five other suppliers, the level of power you have in a negotiation is very different from when you're the only one that they can deal with. Yeah? If you sell something unique that you're the only one on the market that actually sells this, you have a very different level of power in the negotiation. So just asking yourself that question will help you, you know, to understand, you know, how is this conversation going to go? But there's so many more questions that you need to ask. And what I experienced from real life is that most buyers, they come in, they have a pre-prepared presentation, 60 slides, talking about, you know, we used to start in 1924, father and mother business, blah, blah, blah. Then we evolved into the kids took over, blah, 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 blah. And that's about 20 slides is that introduction. At that stage, they haven't asked a single question. They're just sending information. And personally, I've never gone into a meeting with a prepared presentation. Never. Because the first thing I want to do is ask questions like, hey, what's happening? What's going on? What are your struggles? What are you dealing with? What's happening? How can I help you? You know, because if I can't help, there's no point in me trying to sell something. And there needs to be an opportunity to help people. And I rarely found salespeople doing that, coming in with their own story, with their own perspectives, rather than thinking about, you know, what does the other party want? What do they need? And how can I help them achieve that? Which I think is one of the most powerful things to do as a seller, and that's why, you know, I think the first thing, one of the first pictures I have in the book is one on, I'm sure you've seen it. It's one on perspective. You know, you see, and I can explain the picture because it's actually beautiful. It's not my picture; it's somebody else. But it's you see an island in the ocean, a very small island, and a person on the island, and then the second picture is a person in a small boat on the sea. The person in the boat sees the land and they shout, land, land, land in sight. And the person on the island shouts, boat, boat, boat. You know, and I love this picture because the person on the island has been stuck on the island thinking, finally, I can get off the island. The person in the boat thinking, I've been on sea for so many, and finally I have some land. I can go to the land. But you know, same situation, different perspectives, and that's how I see buying and selling. We're in the same situation. You know, we need each other because eventually, if you want to buy something, you need the seller to sell it to you. So you need each other, but we always think from our own perspectives rather than thinking, hold on, I'm here on the island, but the other person in the boat, they might be stuck in the boat for a long time. Is there another island or a bigger island in the neighborhood at all? Or am I stuck on sea afterwards? And I think that perspective is really, really powerful. So understanding, you know, both perspectives, not just yours, but also the perspective of the other party.
I think that's great. And before I want to sort of go to the fourth chapter where you talk about the buyer's world. But before that, I have a question. As a buyer, how do you think a salesperson can find out your priorities or your situation without actually meeting? Because as you and I both know, getting the meeting is the biggest problem today.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody wants to meet. Now, you don't want to meet because you don't know whether they're of any value to you or not.
Yeah.
Yet he has to sort of understand what your priorities are without meeting you.
Yeah.
How can one pull that off according to you?
To really get in touch with the buyer, you mean? To really get into the meeting. So so the first question actually is, how relevant are you to the buyer?
Right.
Because if you really struggle to get a meeting, and there's a model that's called the Kaljic model. I will not explain it in detail, but in the book I'll explain it. It's a model where it basically shows how important are you to a buyer. If you're a low spend item, so if you sell toilet paper, a buyer will not have interest in you. If you work at a chocolate company, you sell cocoa, you can expect the buyer to be more interested in you. So it's all related to the level of spend that you have with a buyer. That's one element, and that makes it easier to get in touch with them. But I also find that most people are not very creative to get in touch with buyers these days. So they just try sending an email. You know, you see that a lot happening. Just sending an email out of the dark to a buyer. Hey, how are you? I have something interesting I would like to sell, blah, blah, blah. That kind of conversation. Buyers get hundreds of emails of those a day. So what do? They just press delete because they can't answer everyone. So so think about how can you creatively get in touch with a buyer. And one of the books I'm personally a big fan about is a book Influence by Cialdini. I'm not sure you're familiar with the book. It talks about influencing principles. So how do you influence people? I think that book is full of tips on how to really reach out to buyers. You know, the authority principle, the liking principle. There are principles you can apply for buyers to open up to you as a person and to embrace actually meeting you. Because if you're an authority in your respective field, buyers would love to talk to you because they can learn from you. They can learn some new information from you. So it's more about creativity to get in touch than anything else. So don't be like everyone else. Yeah? Be different than everyone else, and that makes it easier to get in touch. I'm not saying it's 100% guaranteed, but it makes it easier to get in touch.
Sure. Let's go to chapter 4, where you talk about the buyer's world.
Yeah.
And you have basically talked about how it relates to the real business that is happening today. So tell us a bit about the company expectations and the procurement maturity that you talk about there.
Yeah, so I use one of the examples I use is the BCG matrix, which is the Boston Consulting Group. They have a matrix where you can see at what stage a company is in terms of their product life cycle. And it goes all the way from, where a company doesn't know how successful the product, when they launch a new product, they don't know how successful it's going to be, all the way up to it's going to be very successful, huge, high profitable, all the way to, it's now fading out because it's not attractive anymore because the markets have changed. And it happens with every product, but it just sometimes takes a long time for that to reach that. But the procurement priorities are always linked to this product life cycle. So if, for example, it's a product that is really, sales are going up 30%, 40%, 50%. Procurement's role is not to cut costs. It's to make it happen, ensure deliveries. Because if you're growing 30%, 40%, you need to facilitate that growth. You need to make sure there's availability of products. If, however, you find that the business is more of a cash cow business where growth has been like 2-3% a year, but it has a high market share, you'll find that actually a buyer is very much focused on cutting costs. Yeah, they're very much interested in cutting costs to make sure that, you know, the profitability increase, because it's a cash cow. They want more money from that. You know? So they want to cash the cow, basically. So just understanding where in the product lifecycle an organization is can help you understand their priorities. So before you even meet them, you can already kind of assess, you know, what priorities do they have as an organization, and just by doing this this simple analysis, and it's not 100% foolproof, yeah, because sure, there can be different priorities, but it's 95% accurate. Yeah? So the only caveat is that a product lifecycle is per product; it's not for an entire organization. So some organizations have different products and different elements of the life cycle, so that makes it, you know, a bit trickier. But if you really do an analysis on their biggest brands, you can actually see where they are, and that will probably be their approach to procurement. And so make it happen, easier to get in, because they just want, you know, trustworthy suppliers. When they're in a cash cow situation, they just want, you know, you to be cost competitive, you know, to provide best pricing to them. So that's even before you step into the room, you can already tell by analyzing this.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break,
one of the most important ones in negotiation is power, the level of power. And I'm not even talking about actual power. I'm talking about perceived power, which is fundamentally different, because you can have actual power, but if the other party has perceived power, that's even more important. And to give you an example, you know, what if I would walk into the airport, I would dress up really nicely, I would bring two people in suits wearing sunglasses looking like bodyguards, and I would cut the line. Yeah, just me. As a normal person, I would cut the line. Everybody would think that must be somebody important.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it.
As you mentioned, that there are two components to a procurement or a buyer success. One is, if it is a high growth product, it is ensuring that the supply chain is stable and constant and consistent. And if it is not, then how to cut prices. Now, your ability to understand where you are and thereby not undercutting your price or sticking to a price, your relative positioning in terms of negotiations come up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the procurement or the buyer is in charge of that budget. So negotiation becomes a key component of this relationship.
For sure, yeah.
So what are the points that you think sellers should keep in mind when they're negotiating?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important ones in negotiation is power, the level of power. And I'm not even talking about actual power, I'm talking about perceived power, which is fundamentally different, because you can have actual power, but if the other party has perceived power, that's even more important. And to give you an example, you know what? What if I would walk into the airport? Mm-hmm. I would dress up really nicely. I would bring two people in suits wearing sunglasses looking like bodyguards, and I would cut the line. Yeah, just me. As a normal person, I would cut the line. Everybody would think that must be somebody important.
Yeah.
So we'll let them cut the line, because it's probably, I don't know, a high profile politician or a movie actor or whatever. Yes, right. Movie star. In fact, I'm not. My actual power is zero, but I created perceived power. Perceived power is also what gets negotiations going. So in negotiations, it's always about perceived power. The one with perceived power wins. And what buyers are really good at is to create perceived power. And how do they do that? For example, one of the ways how they do that is by organizing tenders or RFPs. When they launch an RFP, a request for proposal, there is an automatic assumption that they send it to multiple suppliers. Doesn't have to be, but that's the assumption people have. And thus they create perceived power, because all of a sudden there's four or five or whatever number of suppliers bidding for the same. You feel that the buyer has power to make the decision. So you feel that, you know, you're going to give them what they want, because, you know, that's how you feel you want to, you can do business with them. And that's a way that, that buyers play that game of perceived power very well. Doesn't have to be. You could be the only participants in the RFP. But you don't know. So your actual power might be high. Your perceived power might be low, just because the way that the game is played. And from this perspective, what I always advise, because the next question is, yeah, how do you circumvent that? The simple thing is that if you are exactly like everyone else in the market, if you're selling exactly the same products, for sure price will be important. Yeah, because then it's only about price. So the way how to make, you know, the discussion not about price is to make yourself unique. And you make yourself by unique by, you know, providing something, a product or a service that nobody else can provide. And it can be a niche, that's fine, right? But as long as the more unique it is, the more a buyer has to work with you, and the less actually they can play the game of perceived power. Yeah. Because you're the only one they can work with. And if you know it, they don't have any power to negotiate with you. You have the power to negotiate. So that's one way of making sure that you change the balance of power in the negotiations.
So tell me, if I'm a commodity seller, right? There are being unique in a market is not common. Let me put it that way. It's not impossible, but it's rare. You have a new set of technology which you can bring to the table, but that may be a 1 year, 2 year kind of horizon, and then people will catch up and so on, right?
Yeah.
You remember the CVT days of cars and so on and so forth. So, I mean, somebody makes it, or they then start selling it to the competitor, whatever. The point is that if you are a commodity seller, which means you have other competitors, you know that there are other competitors, how do you create this perceived power equation? How do you do that?
Yeah, that's hard. Actually, there's a couple of stories I heard, and I think they're both actually quite interesting, because they are very commoditized markets where people created a niche. One of them actually is a car company. They sell cars, like pretty commoditized business, and it was set up by ladies, and they said we run a ladies business for ladies. You know, and they really market everything around, you know, if as a woman you want to buy a car, come to us, because you get honest advice. We talk about the things you want to hear, not about what the guys want to hear. And they sell cars just to women. And it's perfect in a niche, because nobody does that. It's a niche. So when as a woman, oh, I'm not a woman, but if I would be a woman, I would go there, because, you know, they understand me. They talk about the things I want to talk about, rather than, you know, the guy's world that it is right now. So that's one example. Like, they created a niche out of a commoditized market. One other story is not my story. It's a story by another salesperson who's a famous salesperson in the Netherlands. He talks about, he calls it the night painter. And I like it. A person had a painting business, and they there's a lot of painting businesses. So everybody paints, and they said, we do a night service. We just paint during the nights. I'm like, why would there be interest? They said, well, there's a lot of interest, because actually a lot of shops, they want to open up during the day, they want to have the work done during the night. So we just do night painting, and we paint the buildings during the nights. We take away the stuff, we paint it, and then we put it back. And next morning, part of your shop is painted without any interference to your normal business. You can open up, you know, during normal working hours. So, it is a bit about creativity, for sure. But if you're really, really, really in a commoditized business, and it's a very transparent commoditized business, that's going to be hard, and you're just going to have to accept that it's going to be a price game. Which means you're going to have to look at your internal cost structure. How can I be the most cost efficient organization out there, serving my customers? That is the default go to if you don't have this level of creativity to find your own niche.
Both are very interesting stories. Actually, I can literally imagine that in every market, these two businesses can be opened up like now. right?
Yeah, they can.
Selling cars to women and painting during the night. That's fantastic. Talking about knowing your buyer, I think obviously that's one of the things that we have been touching upon multiple times. See, one is that publicly available data, right? So for instance, if it is Mars, I can go and check your balance sheet, how much money you're spending in cocoa, this and that. I mean, some information is there, right?
Yeah.
Then I can read up industry reports. Okay, in the chocolate byproduct industry, what's going on? I can spend money and do that. But end of the day, we are dealing with a human being, and lot of sales talk and lots of advice is around that. And right. I just want to know. It's like it sort of takes you back to the old days where people are, human to human connection. I know that your son plays baseball or soccer, and I keep talking to you about that and so on and so forth. And that's what helps me build relationship. Where is it today, actually? How do you really understand not only the facts of the customer's or the buyer's business, but actually how do you find out and relate to things that actually matter to him?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So there's a story actually in Cialdini's book on influence that I mentioned earlier, and the story is actually quite funny. It's an American car salesman who has been more successful than any car salesman in the history. Like, and everybody's wondering, how does he do it? He sold twice as many cars as any other car salesman, consistently. It's not like 1 year lucky or 2 years lucky. No, he was like consistently for 40 years, he was selling twice the amount of cars as any salesman. And I'm like, what did he do? He never told what he did until he retired. And then he told this story. And what he did is, whenever somebody visited, he wrote down everything that he noticed. How they drank their coffee, the name of their dog, the birthday of their kids, where they went on holiday. I don't know, you name it. Like a whole range of information. It's like CRM squared, whatever. It was a huge effort. He was good at remembering faces. That was his benefit. So, and that was some of the prerequisites. So whenever somebody came into the building to buy a car, and said, "Hey, how are the kids? Little Frankie must be 6 years old right now, you know," and blah 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 blah. These people, he built an immediate connection with people, right. And the interesting part is, and this is a bit linking back to Cialdini's liking principle. It's the principle of liking. We like to do business with people that we like. The more obscure things you know about somebody, you know, the better the relationship will be. You know, if you remember how they drank their coffee, or if you remember, you know, where they went on holiday last time, and you went there as well. Finding these kind of commonalities really helps to build a connection with a buyer, and we don't do enough of that. You know, a funny story: a friend of mine actually, he was he used to work at a financial institute many years ago, and he had one customer who never paid their bills on time, never. And he was getting a bit frustrated with that. And he had to call them every week, like, "Hey, where's the payment? Where's the payment?" And he found out through conversation that this person was a big fan of a Dutch soccer club. This friend of mine has absolutely no knowledge about soccer whatsoever. He doesn't understand soccer. He doesn't know soccer. He just doesn't care. So what he did, he started, you know, deep diving into the soccer club, you know, in their achievements and their games and everything. And Monday morning, he called again this guy to request a payment of the invoices. And then he started talking about soccer. He said, "Hey, did you watch the match last night? I think the yellow card was, you know, shouldn't have been given by the referee, and that goal was a really great goal, blah, blah." He started talking about names of players. First 5 or 10 minutes, he started talking about this. And then towards the end of the conversation, he said, "Oh, by the way, we still have an invoice sending." He said, "I'll pay it. Oh, no worries. I'll get it paid. Done." I said, all the hassle, and all I had to do is understand, you know, his background, his personal story, for me to understand how you get things done. And this is you do stuff for people that you like. And if you're also a fan of, you know, the same football club, if the perception is created, you're a fan of this football club, it helps you to achieve things with people. And there's a strong caveat which I want to mention, because you shouldn't fake it, right? Mm. So if somebody's into sailing and you pretend you're into sailing but you're not, that can go, you know, into the wrong direction. So use it appropriately, yeah, and ethically in conversation. Sure. I think that's important. Yeah.
Sure. I think people suss out when people are not being genuine. and just being, just being very shallow and surface.
So, checking out somebody's LinkedIn or Facebook profile helps you to get this kind of information. But if you're saying, look, I checked out your Facebook profile and I see you have two kids, and like, it becomes a bit scary, right? So you have to be careful with that.
Absolutely. So you actually paint these four scenarios of success, right? Buyer wins, nobody wins, seller wins, and both win. So tell us a bit about this, because I personally always believe that both win is what you need to target for. If the buyer wins and, you know, you have sort of negotiated him down to the bone, he's going to fail down the line. He will not be able to deliver what you want. And if you have taken the buyer for a ride for whatever reason and you have charged exorbitantly, you're going to lose that deal sooner or later for sure. Nobody wins is a bad scenario. I mean, where that's bad, obviously. I mean, somebody pays, somebody does the work, but no purpose is served, right? So tell us a bit about how you sort of see this from your point of view.
So the model is created by combining two other models. And I don't want to make it too complex by discussing those models, but those two other models are basically, one is the perspective of the buyer, one is the perspective of the seller. You have to combine both perspectives, actually, to get this combined perspective of the market where, you know, parties win. And I talk about blue and red, and I think that's important to recognize. And blue is when you negotiate, you're typically sitting on the chair, you sit on the blue chair or a red chair, and blue is very much price driven. It's one party wins, they use power to negotiate, it's very cold, it's secretive, you know, it's a bit more competitive. Red is much more collaborative, working together, seeing how we can partner up, create something great together. And the model you're referring to, where both parties win, it can only happen when both chairs are red. Because when both chairs are red, the table is red. And when the table is red, you really can get to a great deal. Mm. When both chairs are blue, the table is blue, nobody really wins. You're just fighting and one wins maybe a little bit, the other party, but it's never a long-term deal. The complexity exists when there's one chair is blue and one chair is red, because the table will be blue. And this is interesting because typically, and I'm generalizing now, but typically sellers are very red in their approach. And they want a partnership, they want long-term, they want to build a relationship with the other party. And the buyer can be very blue in their behavior, you know, getting the best price, give me the lowest price. When that happens, the seller will be giving and the buyer will be taking. And that's when the table is blue. The buyer is very, it's negotiating in a blue table. You as a seller hoping it to be red, but it's actually blue. You're negotiating in a blue table. And that's when the buyer wins. There can also be reversed, that the buyer is red and the seller is blue. And that's when the seller wins. But again, this is also a blue negotiation. I think what you're referring to is really when two chairs are red and the table is red. That's where you get real win-win. And I agree. Yeah, that's in the long run, that's always the best outcome. But if one party thinks they have more power than the other, they will turn blue and the negotiation will become blue. And that's unfortunately what happens a lot of the times, you know, in these kind of conversations. Yeah.
Right. So where do you think this is going, this relationship of buyer and seller? Is it, do you see any change? Obviously, there are requirements for both sides to understand the other instead of making it a power play where one side wants to, because I think in all fairness, it's really not a competition. It is really not a war. We are not enemies. So you need to get there. However, as you said, the buyer would want to spend as little as they can. That will be a default. No buyer is going to say, okay, I'm going to pay 10% more because otherwise this guy is going to die. So how do you see this going forward?
I don't want to be negative here, but I think the future is more blue than red. Because when I talked about 25 years ago, when people go to a bar, play golf or play whatever, and have a drink and a meal together, very red. Yeah, you know each other, you like to work together, and then you would agree something on the spot to work there. That's very red. A lot of buyers have evolved over time. You know, with the pressure on cost savings, they become more blue in their approach. So tables, negotiation tables have become more blue as a result. Sellers have struggled to adapt to that. But I think they will eventually, they're going to have to adapt to that. So what you'll see, the risk of sellers becoming more blue as well. What buyers have become really good at, and that's why they can be blue, is because if there's five suppliers that can offer the same service, I can say to the one, do you offer 100? And they say, yeah, I offer 100. I go to the next, say, do you offer 95? Do you offer 90? Do you have 85? So I can just play them against each other. That's what buyers are doing. That's an RFP process or an auction process or tender process. That's what they do. And that's very blue behavior. I don't see that changing a lot. So let me tell you an anecdote. My old boss, when I started, and I started in 2002 in procurement, my old boss said, Mark, I want you to visit suppliers 2 days a week. Go out there, go see your suppliers, understand how they're doing. I was doing logistics buying in those days. I had to go to the terminal in Rotterdam. I went to Antwerp. I went to see suppliers, see their operations, because I want you to understand what you're buying. I want you to know what you're buying. Nowadays, I don't see a lot of buyers going out to their suppliers, and definitely not 2 days a week. My boss forced me to do that 2 days a week. Rarely, because they buy behind their laptops, they work from home, behind their screens, they're trying to buy something, which basically means they have no clue what they are buying. They're just buying based on numbers and on spreadsheets, etc. So they don't understand anymore. When I was buying logistics, I knew what I was buying because I went to see the supplier and I knew if they said we're struggling with this or we have an opportunity there, I understood, okay, that's how it all fits into the bigger picture. A lot of buyers don't know that. But the problem is if you don't understand what's happening behind the scenes, you automatically become blue because you don't know. You just don't care. You just want the best price. If you do understand, you could think, all right, okay, this is how we could make it work. And that could make it much more red in terms of cooperation, thinking, oh, if we would do this, we could combine that. And if we do this kind of service, we could create something nice together. That's very red. But you need to understand what is going through is a seller's mind first as a buyer. And I don't see buyers taking enough time for that these days, unfortunately, because I think there's so much more added value. When we were doing packaging buying in the old days, and this is many years ago, we used to run tenders and we would save 2-3% year on year. At one point in time, I set up a project with a project team where we started working with a supplier to see, you know, how can we do better packaging buying. Turned out that we were very much over specifying some of our packaging material. So we asked for more packaging, thicker material, more folds, more glue, asking for, you know, over-specified material. Once we sat down with the supplier and understood that actually we could buy a lower specification, I was able to save 15%. You know, and this is interesting because my blue tendering approach would give me 2-3%. My red cooperative approach would give me 15% savings. So I see a lot of buyers thinking, going for the 2-3% every time, you know, because thinking that's the best deal. Although if they would really open up, work together, they could find bigger opportunities because then you're leveraging the expertise of your suppliers to get better deals. Yeah. And I think this is an opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, there are two. One is past, one is potential, the future, that I would like to touch upon. One of the reasons this potentially happened is because of globalization. Earlier, yep, the supplier and the buyer were all by and large in the same place, right? In many cases, they grew up, went to the same school and played for the same team and so on. So that relationship was actually pre-existing.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
But with globalization, when you are buying, for instance, you're sitting in Netherlands, buying from India or from Africa or from wherever, that ability to touch went away.
Absolutely, yeah, 100%. Because the further the distance, the less likely you are to like the other person. The closer they are to you, the more you like them. It's
because cultural diversity, habits, everything is different, right? Even if you happen to go there, you may or may not like the person because he's so different or she's so different, right? So that's the past, and I guess that's potentially one of the reasons why we are where we are. The other thing is, lot of this kind of buying and selling will be done by AI in the future.
Yeah.
Lot of it where nobody's going to talk to anybody and it will be done without any human intervention. Do you see something like that happening?
Yeah. The only issue I see with that is, and this is human nature, because what happens, you're right, huh? That could be like the very transactional part of the process. But then what happens, two people are going to judge, the seller and the buyer are going to judge the deal made by bots, thinking, I think there was a better deal to be had. Yeah, that will be definitely buyer's nature. Yeah. Seller thinking, that's a bit cheaper than I would have sold it for. You know, and then we start to engage ourselves. So I think bots need to really, really, really improve. because they need to, you know, take into consideration the human, the level of satisfaction from a human perspective as well into that equation, not just because factually it can be the best deal. The numbers could be the best deal ever for both parties, but then still the sentiment thinking, I think there was more to be had,
yeah.
Which is a very human human element. So I think that needs to be that needs to be dealt with as well in that process, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Well, Mark, this was fantastic. I would let you sort of wrap it up with the two final questions that you have in the book. So go for it. What are the two final questions for the journey ahead?
Yeah, so the two final questions I have in the book is, do you think it's possible to go on this journey with customer X? So the customer X is the customer you're talking about. So that's where basically I'm checking, you know, you've gone through 45 questions. You know, do you think that it's possible to do that? Because it's more of a sense check. Mm. And then the last question is, what steps are you going to take to, you know, to create this opportunity? Because that's always hard, because, you know, you read a book, you leave it on table and then think, ah, I should do something, and then you go on doing what you've been doing all day long. So I think those are the two final questions of the book, to make sure you're actually putting into an action plan to execute it, because that's always the hardest part to do that.
Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And actually, so my next book, actually, what I'm trying to do, just to finish that part of it, is I want to help buyers get a better perspective of the bigger picture. So I'm helping them to create a strategy. Is to get them out of their operational pressure and actually go into more of a, let's have a broader perspective of what's happening in the market, rather than just pushing my current supplier for lower prices, because that's the behavior I've been seeing. You know, I want to give them a bigger perspective. So I'm actually, the second book, even though it's for procurement, it's also to help sales professionals in the long run. So
Sure. I think a broader perspective of where the world is critical, because as I said, you may kill a supplier because he has no option at that point, but it will actually jeopardize your business down the road.
You're just
sort of pushing disaster while you think you're winning a war. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this has always been one of my challenges, because what's happening naturally, my supply base is shrinking because of mergers, because of bankruptcy. So it's shrinking. So I was always looking to expand my supply base because I always wanted to have a level of competition. But buyers who have been too aggressive, pushing companies into bankruptcy, will end up having one supplier, and then they have to work with them. You know, so that's a very short-sighted view. But it will bite them in the face at one point in time, for sure.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, very very wise words to end with.
Mark, thank you so much for it was a delightful discussion, and I'll
likewise.
I will expect that you let me know the moment you are ready with your new book.
Yeah, I will for sure.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you as well.
We have a great lineup of authors like Charles Green, Richard Harris, and Enrico Gallorini over the next few episodes, with insightful conversations on breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.